Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, March 23rd. We get the latest about the storm recovery here on Oahu from Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi, what the public needs to know to stay safe as communities clean up. We also hear from State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen about North Shore road repairs amid landslide threats, and how the Middle East war could impact tourism as jet fuel prices start to climb. A recent report on liquefied natural gas contained errors in its estimate for the state. The discussion over our energy future comes at a critical time. And the cost of living is important to all of us, how classical musicians are making ends meet. And good, kind things God like tell you. The Bible, according to Jehovah's Witness in Hawaiian Pidgin. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us live this morning is Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi. He just got out of a briefing with emergency management officials this morning and has the latest on what the public needs to know here on Oahu as we try to clean up after the back-to-back storms. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, Catherine. Thank you for having us on. I appreciate this.
Well, this is such an important issue. You know, we need to get good information out. What do you want to tell residents here on Oahu?
Yeah, well, we have lots of information. I think that's the good news, and all of it speaks to helping provide relief for those folks out on the North Shore. And right now, that's where our focus is to help our residents recover safely and as quickly as possible. And I just want to give a shout-out right now to Governor Green and Ed Sniffen over at the Department of Transportation. The collaboration going on between city and state has just been excellent. It's been that way all through the weekend. But as you know, and I was out there Saturday afternoon on-site at ground level, what we were looking at was really daunting, to be very honest with you. The amount of mud flow and flooding and the damage from it, you know, when you get up close to it, it becomes not only very real, but you can see the power of this storm. But again, I'm very happy and so relieved and proud, quite honestly, of our first responders, because they provided 233 rescues of people who were in very dangerous situations. It got everybody out safely. Only two people went to a hospital, and we had no fatalities. That said, the segue to what we're doing now on the cleanup is massive, because the damage was massive. So we have all resources going on. Today we have more than two dozen roll-off dumpsters that are out there being delivered to Wailua. They've already been there now to assist with debris removal and cleanup. And we're working directly again with Ed Sniffen, the DOT. Both he and Roger Babcock this morning attended a community meeting out there at 8 o'clock. Our Department of Facilities and Management has excavators and wheel loaders in Wailua for cleaning up debris in the roads. And they're also deploying an additional 10 dump trucks to assist the Department of Transportation with debris cleaning. And we've also set up a dedicated website that will serve as a one-stop hub for services, information, and recovery. And I'll provide that to you in a bit. In addition to that, the city has had a longstanding contract, which I learned today. This is my first really major disaster as mayor, with the mainland outfit that comes in, and they do a really great job. They have already existing contracts with contractors all over the island, so they come in and do what they call TDSRs, which is temporary debris storage and reduction sites, which is designed to process the debris into that which can be recycled, burned, or landfill. Because that's the other part of this. It's what we have been going through since yesterday. It's not the kind of trash you just put in front of your house. In fact, the trash is so massive in its buildup, and it's so complex because it contains, you know, all kinds of things, from green waste to that stuff that can go to H power to metals and everything else. So we're going all out with everything to make this, give the people that are out there a sense of relief. Because honestly, I was in the Wailua fire station the other day, you know, 3 feet of mud. And when you get into something like that and you look at it, you go, how can you possibly even remove this? So That said, we'll try to make the recovery as easy as possible, and this is really important. I hope that people hear this. We're removing all the barriers wherever we can. For example, the Department of Environmental Services is waiving the tipping fees to help residents dispose of their debris. We're waiving all tipping fees. Our Department of Planning and Permitting is allowing emergency repairs to begin immediately without a permit. So as long as safety requirements are being met and a permit is filed, there'll be no fees. They can begin the work immediately. DPP is also waiving all building permit fees that are related to the storm damage and cleanup to help accelerate recovery efforts. We want to make this as smooth as we can. And so to find a better way to say it, if your home needs urgent repairs, you can start that work now. Please know you can start that work now. One of the more challenging things we had to deal with, and Ernie Lau, we were talking about this on Saturday afternoon, is that we had some trouble with our water system out there. So we have a boil water notice, which is still remaining in effect on the North Shore, the boil water. So please do not use freshwater showers or sinks in city parks from Mokulea to Turtle Bay, because the water's, we're still in the process of testing it now. We've got it kind of working up, but there's not only a lot of brown water out there, but we're concerned about people, doing anything, drinking anything that would be contaminated. So we are providing clean drinking water. It's available at Banzai Skate Park and Wailua District Park, and we hope to have the whole water situation cleaned up as soon as possible. But right now, we want people to err on the side of caution. And this may be an abundance of caution, but this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, you know? public safety is tantamount. And, you know, I know you mentioned the Wailua Fire Station. Yeah, I heard that the firefighters were working out of Mililani. Big shout out to our first responders and the city crews that have been out there. I know in East Honolulu that, you know, on 16th Avenue, they hit some major flooding. You know, the crews were there before the rains, and they were clearing out the culverts and the drains, and they were back out it again on Friday afternoon. So big shout out.
Well, I can promise you this. I have been on record of telling the people before the storm that they would be able to count on the people from the city and the county, all of our first responders and all of our other teams. And I want to emphasize that point again. We're not going to disappoint anybody in our performance from the standpoint of trying to be there. And incidentally, what we just talked about, I was talking about the fire station number 14 in Wailua that took on the significant flooding and operations there. They've been temporarily relocated, but they're working out of the district park, which is right across the street. But they took in 3 feet of water and mud. It was unbelievable. But thank you for that acknowledgement. We've told our team that now we tried to be at our best during these last two storms while the storms themselves were going on. But now that hopefully it's behind us and we got on some parts of Oahu more than 40 inches of rain, which is incredible. And I know, if I can just offer this, I'm certainly not saying to be controversial, but I know the governor said it, and I saw it in National Services, that this is the worst storm in 20 years. And so I don't mean, but I talked to long-term residents out in Wailua Saturday when we were there. People close to my age have been up there around for 7 or 8 decades telling me this is the worst they've ever seen in their life.
Well,
so I don't dramatize it.
You had to make some difficult decisions, you know, about the Honolulu Festival, not to have the parade, not to have the fireworks. But, you know, driving around after that first storm came through and seeing all those trees over, I think that was the right call, just because, you know, public safety, you know, you just don't want people to get hurt.
No, we don't. And we have our HPD offices all across the island conducting traffic control and providing security. And look, I'm proud about you. I think we made a lot of good calls. The one thing, if I could turn back the hands of time, I don't think there was any way for us to know this. Thursday night, when we knew we were in for the Kanalo, even the National Weather Services was saying this was going to be a weaker system, but nonetheless we get rain, and we were concerned about that additional rain because we knew from the first Kona low that grounds were already saturated. We already knew our reservoirs were full, and so there was some real concern there as to even 2 or 3 inches of rain. But we got 10 inches of rain in 3 hours. That deluge was not anticipated, which then ultimately led to sirens going off in the middle of the night and the evacuations that happened. I felt I felt that, you know, we were so well prepared for the first one. We went on a couple of days ahead of time, alerting people. We even had to overcome the cynics. Yeah, you know that this, and we told them, this system, based on what we're seeing on the radar, is bigger than anything we've ever seen before. As it turned out, that proved to be true. I just wished we had, if we had that information ahead of time that we were in for that, we might have been able to, I'm not sure what we could have prevented, but we might have been able to make sure that people were aware and we could have protected them and gotten them out of there sooner.
Well, it's tough, you know, but got to keep the public safe. We'll learn from this moving forward. But thank you so much, Mayor, for your time this morning.
You're welcome, Catherine. Thank you. One last thing. We're just asking people to avoid unnecessary travel going out there around Camp Otaki and Otaki Camp in Wailua this week. And if people can just stay away, be aware of that. And one last thing. If people would like to contribute or make cash donations, we're accepting them through trusted organizations such as the Hawaii Community Foundation, as well as partners like the Red Cross, Hawaii Food Bank, Salvation Army, and Aloha United Way. You know, need money, not other things, not food, not clothing. People need money. That has the greatest and the best impact. It's the easiest for us to deal with, but more than anything, it allows us to provide the best relief.
Okay,
thank you,
well,
Catherine, for this opportunity.
And thank you so much, Mayor. We've been hearing from Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi. For more of storm coverage, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, a landslide over the weekend hit Waimea Bay. It is the second in as many weeks, and repair crews were already on site trying to restabilize a landslide caused by the first Kona low. Transportation Department Director Ed Sniffen spoke with the Conversation's Kevin Allen on Thursday about the repairs and the decision to try and keep traffic flowing going forward.
The soil had moved downwards about 8 feet, and we could see that and measure it because we had an old guardrail that was out there before. And we could see where the new posts were and how far it had sunk. So definitely it's a concern when we see soil movement like that. It's like for a 60-foot area. When we started looking at our roadway to see how it affected it, our road was still solid and still stable. But that being said, anytime we had seen heavy trucks running through that area or a lot of traffic running through, we saw some of the soil start slumping down some more. So out of an abundance of caution and to make sure that we had enough room for our contractors to work, we shut down the lane, the Makai side lane that's next to that slope for about 200 feet or so to ensure that we didn't have any vehicles running near that slope. We shut that lane down 24/7.
Right. And I know there's been some kind of immediate slope restabilization efforts done already. Could you describe what those are?
Yes. So our contractor went out there starting from yesterday. They cleared that area of loose material where the slope had been exposed. We started installing anchors through that slope. We were looking at 60-foot anchors to get down as deep as possible to make sure that we could stabilize that whole roadblock. The good thing is when we started drilling, we started hitting hard rock at about 25, 30 feet, which allowed us to shorten our drill holes and make sure we could anchor all of our anchor material into the rock. We drilled about 28 to 30 of those. And we shotcreted the face, so we put in a shotcrete or concrete layer on top of that slope to stabilize it. It's setting now, and once that sets, we make sure that the material that's exposed now is now stabilized. It'll take us about a week or so to make sure that we can stabilize that whole area first. Then we can try and see how we can adjust our lane closures out there.
Could you tell me more about maybe some of those additional prevention or maintenance that will be going into that slope?
Absolutely. So the good thing about the system that we're putting in now to temporarily stabilize the face, it will also be the permanent solution in the future. So right now that concrete or that shotcrete face that we're putting in is just that 6-inch temporary layer. That's to make sure that we can get to a point where we can open up the roadway fully for access both ways as soon as possible. Once that's done, our contractor will transition to night work. He'll stabilize that area more, make sure that we can clear out some of the vegetation in that area, and set up to shoot or cast a thicker wall that will stabilize that slope in the long term. When we put that wall in place, of course, nobody wants to look from the beach up at that slope and see gray concrete. So we're going to make sure that that outer layer is going to be sculpted and stained to ensure that it blends better into the slope than just a gray concrete wall. Once that's in, that whole road base in that area will be stabilized long term.
I see. And kind of touching on that point of just stabilization, I mean, has there been, I guess, surveys or looks at that whole area? Because, you know, that whole Waimea Bay area is all cliff face and slopes. And especially with all of this heavy rain, is there any other points of concern or areas that you guys are looking into?
Oh, absolutely. For the most part, we've been looking above the road, though, on the Mauka side of the road. That's where we see a lot of the rock falls and soil falls down into that area. That lower portion below the road has been stable for the most part for a long term. Now that this portion has moved, we're looking at the rest of the slope going further down towards the bay to see if there's other areas that we need to stabilize while we're doing this work anyway to ensure that we don't have to worry about it in the future.
I actually grew up in Pupukea, and I remember being a kid and walking across the bay after that rock slide event in 2000. And that road closure was really just so drastic for everybody living kind of before the bay. You know, there's just no way to get around it. I think for our listeners, can you really talk to me about why, you know, this roadway is so important and it's so important that we kind of keep a close eye on it?
Oh, absolutely. For us, any connectivity that gets disrupted throughout our route is highly impactful to the public. In this area, you can argue that there's another way around for people and you can choose another direction. That being said, it'd be significantly difficult for many people to choose that other route if this one is not open. This one is an economic driver. It gets people to and from their residences, to their jobs, and their opportunities. It also gets our tourists to the areas that they want to get to on the North Shore. So significant need for these routes to make sure that we can keep them open as long as possible. For us, we don't make the decision to shut a route down lightly. We just wanted to make sure that we don't lose this route long term. So we felt we had to take action on this as soon as possible, minimize any potential for damage to that slope by moving traffic away from it and getting out there and stabilizing the slope as quickly as possible.
Right. And I think I know, you know, whenever I drive up north to visit my parents, I'm always driving and I always look at where that 2000 rock slide happened with the fencing there. I mean, man, you see those rocks jutting out and it really does look, it looks quite intimidating.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing. Most of our route throughout our state had been built during a time 60 years ago when those faces looked totally different, right? They were harder, less weathered, more competent material. Over that 60-year period, because of weathering, more loose material starts coming down. And when it comes down to that slope, loose material is big stuff. I know that you remember when we had to drop boulders from that area after the last eddy to make sure that it didn't impact the public. We also had a boulder come down and hit a portion of fence, which required us or made us extend that rockfall netting a little further to ensure that we minimize the potential for it to hit somebody in that area. We make sure we maintain those fencing regularly, but they're coming up on their life cycle. So we're going to make sure that we got to replace them very soon.
You know, what should drivers know kind of going in and out of the North Shore during these restabilization efforts, you know, since it will take some time?
So everybody should know, first, we don't want to shut it down. We don't want to impact them. This was a necessity. And we're trying to make sure that we expedite the stabilization as quickly as possible. So we're making sure we don't waste anybody's time while we're out there. Second, we make sure that we get notification to the public as quickly as possible so everyone understands where there's going to be impacts. Just know, if you have to go through that area, give yourself more time. There's going to be delays because we have the single lane traffic through that area. And last, please take care of our workers that are out there. Drive slow through that construction zone. They're exposed. They're trying to do the best they can to expedite the work to make sure we can protect everybody using that route. So please protect them. And last, we'll keep updating the public on our progress as we adjust our lane closures and adjust our work schedules to try and minimize the impact to everybody that's out there.
That was State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen talking to HPR's Kevin Allen. DOT plans to contraflow traffic over the next 3 weeks. The Makai Lane of Kamehameha Highway near Waimea Bay will be closed as crews work to stabilize the landslide.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NareitHawaii.com.
The Middle East war is adding to the angst over fuel costs. Honolulu Star Advertiser's Allison Schaefer covers tourism issues and has a story today about how this could impact our visitor industry. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Gosh, your headline, Hawaii braces for higher travel costs. Just what we need to hear.
Right. Hawaii is especially vulnerable to rising fuel prices because more than 90% of our visitors last year, 97% of our visitors came by airplane, and nearly all of our goods arrived by plane.
Yeah, and your story kind of breaks down, the cost and how it gets spread around. But obviously, with so many visitors and so many things being brought in, people are concerned for a good reason.
No, absolutely. We don't have driving alternatives or short-hop rail routes or a huge cruise industry, so when jet fuel prices rise, Hawaii feels it faster and harder than almost anywhere else. Because we're so remote, every trans-Pacific flight to Hawaii is long-haul and fuel-intensive, which, magnifies the impact.
And you talked about how some airlines are starting to add a fuel charge.
Yeah, we've already seen a number. Well, a lot of the international carriers already add fuel surcharges at various times, but they go up based on the pricing. And so we've already seen Air New Zealand, Qantas, SAS, Air India, Cathay Pacific, Hong Kong Airlines, and Thai Airways have already announced increases, with more expected, especially from carriers without fuel hedging programs. And a lot of the U.S. carriers don't have fuel hedging programs. So, like, United Airlines has already announced it will trim additional unprofitable routes over the next two quarters, and they're citing specifically elevated jet fuel costs linked to the Iran conflict. Internationally, Air New Zealand has already cut about 5% of its scheduled flights. These moves are telling us that airlines are planning for higher fuel costs to stick around, not just for a short spike.
And you talked to folks at the Hawaii Visitors Bureau. What are they saying?
They're saying basically that the fuel prices haven't, hit the max that they could. In terms of surcharges, a lot of those were set in for April and May, like from Japan Airlines and ANA. So unless we see incredible spikes, we won't see more fuel surcharges before Golden Week, which would be a good thing. But because Golden Week for Japan is like the peak travel period to Hawaii, if it continues, though, and they have to make some sort of emergency adjustment, that would be really bad, as we're looking at a 12-day potentially Golden Week opportunity for the Japanese, which we certainly could use that business.
Yes, and, we've just been so eagerly waiting the return of those visitors because so many of our small businesses rely on those tourism dollars. But everybody's just keeping their fingers crossed that this war in Iran is short-lived.
Yeah, I think that's really the main thing. If it's short-lived, we can weather this storm more than likely. If it's longer term, and it's concerning what the air, if you're looking at airline movement, it's concerning what they're doing, because it doesn't suggest that they see this as a short-term problem.
Well, yeah, I have travel plans on my agenda, and I'm thinking maybe I should book my my flight sooner than later.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best advice for everybody. I know I certainly have tried to book the rest of my travel for this year sooner rather than later, because I guess with just all that uncertainty out there, we just don't know. And for Hawaii, we didn't really need any more uncertainty for the travel market in many ways. It's still recovering across the board, and One of the advantages that we thought we had with the conflict was that we're often seen as a safer place, but now we have this terrible Kona low storm, and we've got a lot of negative headlines out there. So this is going to be difficult.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Allison, for your story.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser Weekend Editor Allison Schapers, who has a story about the rising fuel costs on the tourism outlook. Find her story at staradvertiser.com.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Think of all the reasons you have for making Hawaii Public Radio part of your daily routine. From finding out the why behind the headlines to understanding how a policy change affects families here in Hawaii, you turn to HPR to keep you informed and connected. A service this valuable is worth supporting. Setting up a monthly contribution takes just a few minutes. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org and click donate.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Our vulnerability on oil makes the talk about whether or not Hawaii should have liquefied natural gas in our future more important. But there's been lots of drama swirling over the issue. HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote tracks energy and climate issues for us and joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I understand that the Energy Office has this report out, and at a legislative hearing last week, a UH professor flagged that there were errors in this report.
Yes, errors which the Hawaii State Energy Office is now acknowledging. So what this report was intended to do was to look if we could get ourselves off costly oil by importing for Oahu some liquefied natural gas instead, which is also a fossil fuel, but it's cheaper than oil. And the Hawaii State Energy Office said, we may be able to, if we do this swap, achieve an average of 15% saving on ratepayers' electricity bills, or about $340 per year. And this study has been driving conversation about whether or not the state should make this huge pivot in what its energy mix is made of. But as you said, a little over a week ago, this analysis was called into question by Matthias Fripp, who is an energy policy expert and former UH engineering professor. And so he reviewed not only the published report that people can find at the State Energy Office's website, but the actual data spreadsheets that are used to generate in the models in the study. And he told House lawmakers in a briefing that he believed he had found substantial errors.
The underlying cost-benefit spreadsheet that drove the main figures in the report has various mistakes. Some of them are spreadsheet errors and some of them are more sort of judgment errors, but collectively they raise the apparent benefits of switching from fuel oil or LSFO to LNG by about $1.2 billion. And if you correct those mistakes, you end up with the cost of LNG seems to be about $300 million more than the benefits.
So he was basically saying, yeah, but too rosy a picture here.
Yeah, and so he, as is stated in that bite, found what he believed to be multiple, both data entry errors and judgment errors. But what has really become the flashpoint for this conversation over the last week is that he identified what he believed to be an error in the calculation that underlines all of the cost savings ratepayers may see as a result of the transition to liquefied natural gas. So the calculation that results in the modeling that says we might see $340 in savings a year. He says that he found a mistake where that equation does not include the actual cost of natural gas. And when it's corrected, it says the energy offices overstated the cost benefits of natural gas overall by almost $900 million. And the cost savings that ratepayers would see are actually kind of a wash.
And the Energy Department or Energy Office initially was defensive, I guess, but now it says, oh, yep, there were errors.
Yes. So initially after the hearing, they issued a statement saying that Fripp's assertions were inaccurate. They believed he misunderstood their methodology. But late last week, they delivered a second response to lawmakers, which completely changed course. They concur with Fripp that there's an error, and they didn't get into savings or specifics, but they did acknowledge that if you remove that error, the cost savings for natural gas drops significantly.
Well, I know that the governor, you know, has talked about we need to do the right thing and turn the stone over and figure out, you know, should this be included in our future? And I know that Hawaiian Electric was looking at redoing one of their power plants, but that didn't include liquefied natural gas.
Yes, so this is another part of the story that has come really into focus in the last couple of weeks. The Hawaiian Electric was waiting on feedback from the Public Utilities Commission about its plans to repower the Waiau power plant, which is our oil-fired power plant in Oahu that provides a lot of energy to ratepayers. And the State Energy Office stepped in and asked the PUC to delay its approval of this process so that they could consider other alternatives, ostensibly liquefied natural gas. So this is one of the first instances in which we're seeing questions about whether or not liquefied natural gas should actually be on our grid under the umbrella of these questions about whether or not the Hawaii State Energy Office's evaluations are sound. And so since they've come back with their analysis of the report, they plan to remove all references in the report to those specific savings, but they're not backing down from their original position. They still believe that they can achieve, that the state can achieve some cost savings from importing natural gas.
And you also talked to the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute, right, about those numbers?
Yes. So the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute was asked to do an independent analysis. They say that they have found multiple data entry issues in the study, and they believe that the entire report should be vetted before the state continues to use this as a topic for discussion. They think the entire report should be reviewed for accuracy.
Yeah, because you paid a pretty penny for this.
Yeah, so the state used COVID relief funds, about $900,000 were paid to consultants to put this report together. And Rochelle said it was really surprising based on the amount of work that went into this, that those errors made it to publication.
I'm surprised that they weren't caught. I will say that. I'm surprised that they were not caught. My guess is the work was done and there was a lot of work going into writing it up. And at some point you do put the spreadsheet aside and go on to writing it and drawing your conclusions and trying to explain those. So I can actually understand how it did happen, but given the number of people involved, I'm a little bit surprised.
And so connect the dots for us, you know, because I know the governor has been talking with this Japanese company about investing money here.
Right. So amid this back and forth about the report, Governor Green's office actually shared out a proposal from Japan's largest energy company, JERA, about how they plan to overhaul Oahu's grid to run on natural gas. And interestingly, the proposal projects savings that are much higher than anything we've seen from the energy office. They say they can save ratepayers an average of $500 a year in energy costs. And I got a chance to speak with Eric Montag. He's with JERA's America. And he says they are able to arrive at a number that's much higher because they want to build one big power plant rather than repower several of Oahu's oil-fired power plants. And they want to do this as quickly as possible. They're targeting 2030. That's key because natural gas is a fossil fuel and the state prohibits the use of fossil fuels for power production after 2045. So they have to get this infrastructure online quickly for cost savings. And they suggested that in order to do that, they may try to go outside of the competitive bidding process. So ask the Hawaii PUC to evaluate this project on its own as opposed to in comparison to other alternatives.
Okay, well, we'll see what the PUC does. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HBR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Tom Nichols is at the U.S. Naval War College. He says incompetence is driving the Trump administration right now, and that's a danger to the country as a whole.
I'm really missing, you know, guys in gray suits saying, good morning. Here's the situation. Instead, you get a guy who comes out every morning and makes it about him.
The Trump administration and the death of expertise. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, Hawaii Architects, designing scientific support facilities for the National Science Foundation across Antarctica. FerraroChoi.com.
The high cost of living is on the minds of so many with the war in Iran escalating. HPR's Cassie Ordonio covers culture and arts, and she decided to take a closer look at how classical musicians in Hawaii'i are making ends meet. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this not a new issue. It's tough.
Yeah, it is tough for many artists, but there are artists who make it work. But the reason why we're taking a look at classical musicians is because there is a misconception that classical musicians have money. Or if you go to an orchestra, the misconception is it's reserved for the elite or it's too expensive. Well, that's not always the case. I mean, there are some orchestras like in New York that charge a lot of money for their tickets and they pay their classical musicians well, sometimes over $130,000. That's not the case for Hawaii. And the cost of living, you know, doesn't really always match what musicians are making locally. And historically, actually, classical musicians had to work multiple jobs. We think of Mozart, Beethoven, and Bach. They had to work multiple jobs in order to stay afloat. And we're going way back. Yes. But even in recent years, I'm thinking of Philip Glass. He's a renowned American composer and pianist. Before he became a full-time musician at an orchestra, he worked multiple jobs. He was a taxi driver and a plumber until he became more famous and decided to pursue a full-time work. But I mean, you know, I spoke with many classical musicians and composers in Hawaii who say, you know, it's a norm to work more than one job, sometimes up to three jobs, just to make ends meet in Hawaii. Clara Kim is one example. She's a violinist who works with ensembles. She teaches on the side and do freelance gigs like performing at weddings and whatnot. But she's a freelancer. She's not a part of an orchestra full time. But she says, you know, it's tough and it's a balancing act.
I do truly love being a classical musician, but there have been very distinct moments in my life where I was really ready to quit and just thought, I don't know if this is worth all of these hours of agony or trying to figure out what the next step is or trying to figure out how I can do the things that I really want to do in this, you know, in this career. You know, my parents were not wealthy when we were growing up. And I know there was a lot of sacrifice that they made in order to make sure that I could have access to opportunity, to meet other like-minded musicians, to have those chances to play with others, to, you know, make music with others, and to take lessons and to go to concerts and to sort of be exposed to a lot of things.
You can just hear the passion in her voice about her love for music.
Exactly. And Clara Kim, she's not local. She's actually originally from the continental U.S. But before she came to Hawaii, she's been here about maybe 2 years now. She came from New York and she was making about $60,000 a year as a freelancer. And then when she moved to Hawaii, she came out here because she saw how passionate people were about classical music. And that kind of found her spark in that. But with all the laundry list of jobs that she does, it's technically three, but I'm looking at this paper right now, it's technically more than three. Those jobs bring in an average income of $45,000 to $50,000 a year. And when you kind of look at like maybe how is that like the average wage, that's about maybe $24 an hour. So it's a little bit over the minimum wage, but it's still not enough to make ends meet for her. And she's a freelancer as well. So whatever gig she can get, that's what helps support her. But she also has a partner to help split the rent. And that's kind of like what we're seeing across the state is that you have to live with someone or you have to have family in order to survive out here. But when you look at classical musicians at the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, those full-time musicians, they make a little more than $1,100 per week. But that's in a season of 21 weeks, and that's still not enough to, you know, live in Hawaii. So musicians, they have to do other types of work. The types of trends that I've been hearing from classical musicians, you either work at the symphony orchestra, you perform at weddings, venues, or you teach on the side, mostly teaching at the high school and colleges. I spoke with Michael Thomas Fumai. He's a composer and a composer in residence and director of artistic engagement at the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. He actually works three jobs total. Apart from the orchestra, he works at UH West Oahu, where he teaches music, and he composes music for various projects. And while those jobs add up to more than $100,000 a year for him, he says it's still not enough, and he admitted in an interview that he still has to rely on his family to support him. And so when I asked him if musicians should be paid more, this was his response.
We are the only professional orchestra in the state of Hawaii that are bound by a collective bargaining agreement with our musicians union. So we are paying them a fair wage. Can we do better? Absolutely. Absolutely. Our musicians deserve to be paid, you know, the world. And so, because they're so talented. They're so talented. They can be musicians anywhere else. They can be musicians anywhere else. They can play in orchestras anywhere else in the world. But they have chosen Hawaii because Hawaii is a special place and will go through the gauntlet of the high cost of living to be here.
So the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, they are currently entering negotiations with the union, which is the Musicians Association of Hawaii. And when I talked to Jim Moffat, who's the president, he couldn't give the specific details because they're still in the beginning stage, but they'll be negotiating stuff like higher wages and better work conditions and that sort of thing. But Jim Moffat, you know, he's been at the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra since 1981, actually when it was the Honolulu Symphony. Mm-hmm. So he was there before the bankruptcy, during the bankruptcy, and after. He said that there are efforts to kind of get the orchestra to how it was like to travel and perform across the state. Right now it's only on Oahu, and there's currently bills in the legislature that would appropriate funds, but a lot of classical musicians, you know, they don't want to give up their work and still want to continue, but they'll do whatever it takes to make ends meet to live in Hawaii.
Yeah, that's their dream, right? To play music. But thank you so much, Cassie, for highlighting this.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio, who spent time with some of our classical musicians, talking about how they deal with the high cost of living. You know, it's been about 25 years since the New Testament was first translated into Hawaiian Pidgin. And more recently, Jehovah's Witness has decided to run with the idea, translating its message into a language that it says touches people's heart. Take a listen.
What Matthew write? Chapter 23. You going get it, you scribes and Pharisees. You guys so two-faced. Because you travel all over from Malka to Makai for make one new believer. And when he come one, he going to be more worse than you. And if you deserve for go Gehenna, then even more he deserve for go too.
We sat down recently with Chris Song. He's a regional spokesman for Jehovah's Witness and shares more behind this pidgin outreach.
We are an international group. We're in 241 lands. And actually, we produce content in over 1,000 languages. because we're an international group, one of the things unique about us is whatever we teach, it's the same, no matter what country you happen to be in. And so as a result, we need to produce content in various languages. And Hawaii Pidgin is a language. It's the language of the people of Hawaii, the local people. And when we produced literature or content in Hawaii Pidgin, it really resonated with the locals. It's the language of the heart. Yeah, it's the language that mom and dad spoke to you at home, the one you talked to at school. And so as a result, we wanted to produce literature. And of course, our main source of content is the Bible. And so that's why our organization made the effort to start to produce. And we just recently released the Book of Matthew and the Book of Mark.
And so how's that going over with your members?
They just loved it. I was there at the release, and there was loud cheers. People had tears in their eyes as they, even the brother, there was one of our congregants that read from the book. And for a while, he was all choked up because he couldn't read it, because it was so nice to be able to read it in the language that we grew up on.
And, you know, I heard about this some years ago that you were embarking on this translation. It was in advance, I think, of one of your conventions, and you've got an upcoming convention also later this summer. But talk about how then you use this when you get people coming from all over the world.
Yeah, one of the important things is to reach out and to talk to the people in the community. And when we started using Pidgin and producing and sharing literature and content in the local language, it resonated with them. And if it didn't resonate, if it was not acceptable, we wouldn't have gone this far. I don't believe so. But because it did, and because we had such a huge response, when people hear it, they go, hey, that's the kind, right? That's how we talk. And so the organization made a strong effort to produce content in Hawaii Pidgin.
And talk about how you'll use that in the upcoming convention.
Our convention is Bible-based, and so you're invited to come. Actually, it's July 17th to 19th, and also a second convention, August 14th through the 16th. The Outer Island Pidgin congregations, of which we have 27 congregations in Hawaii. It's the largest growing segment of Jehovah's Witnesses in Hawaii. We even have a group in Puget Sound because of the diaspora, the movement out of Hawaii, but they still talk Ladat.
That's amazing. So right. So really, that's another way to reach people, you know, whether they've been transplanted to Vegas or the far corners of the continent.
And you know what's interesting, Catherine, is it's not just Pidgin speakers. It's mainland people. It's actually, I met someone from Mexico, and they love, because our content is free. It's on our website. They can download it. They can just look at it. And they love it. They say it's simple. It reaches their heart. It connects. I don't know if I got it right, but you know, Hawaii, we had Filipino, we had Chinese, we had Japanese, Portuguese, and they had to figure out how to communicate. And so they spoke simply and to the heart, right to the point. And that's how Pidgin, in my opinion, how Hawaii Pidgin came about. It was people getting along, trying to talk and communicate with each other. And sometimes they threw in some words that were indigenous to them, but after a while it was incorporated into the language.
And you say, yeah, it gets right to the point. Like, I'm just flipping through some of this literature here that you shared with me, but here's one, Before the World Pow.
Exactly. Isn't that?
Yeah. I mean, it just doesn't beat around the bush there.
No. And one of the reasons why we produce literature and content is we want people, especially right now, everything's all pilikia, all over the place. Pilau, the world is in turmoil. The world is not what it used to be. But the Bible, if we read the Bible, it's actually comforting. It provides us with, as the Bible itself says, a future and a hope. There's something better to look forward to.
Yeah. Here's another one. You think God care about you?
Yeah. Yeah. And he does. The Bible says that God cares about you.
And you folks have come out with a Book of Matthew and
Mark.
Mark, yeah. Any challenges in the reinterpretation?
It took an effort, yeah. And we do this, is we're not sitting in some office in New York or some mainland were embedded right into the community. And as a result, they can hear how the local people talk immediately, the idiomatic expressions, and they can test it and see, is this how people are talking right now? So sometimes you read some of the, it's old, a Hawaii pidgin. Yeah, it's not like what we're talking now. A lot of those words, we no longer use them. And new expressions are coming about. So one of the things we found is if we embed our translation offices right in the community, there's a connection that they can make, an immediate response that they can see, hey, this one's going to work, or this one a little bit too far to the right or too far to the left.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was doing research on the pidgin thing with the Bible, you know, it said that that was started, it was a project in 2000, and it took a team of 26 people coming together to work on the translation of the Bible. So do you have a similar thing? You have like committees where you sit there and turn the stone over and over?
Oh, yes, definitely. And we appreciate the fine effort that the Good and Special Book did. In fact, we use it because it's the kind. But we have our own translation. Sometimes there's a little different way that we want to express it for clarity and unity because we're global, right? And so we have a method. One of the things that might be different is we put the word Jehovah or the name Jehovah back into where we feel it should be. And so that's one of the reasons why we have our own New World Translation.
And for our listeners out there who may not be familiar with Jehovah's Witness, what's at the core of the teaching?
The core of the teaching is exactly what the Bible says. If it says to do this in the Bible, we strive to do it. If it says do not, we do not. And so whatever Jesus taught, the expressions he made, the verses in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we follow exactly what the Bible says. That's what we strive to do.
Okay. I'm looking forward to maybe some pidgin songs.
Oh, yeah. In fact, please look at our jw.org website, and you'll find a cross on the top. It'll have English, probably. You can click on that button, and you can pull down Olelo Hawaii, Hawaiian Pidgin, 1,000 languages. And there's pidgin content in songs, things for children, and of course our regular content.
Okay, so you've got two books down. What's the third?
Probably going to follow the Gospels, so probably the next one will be Luke. And so progressively we'll be working on the rest of the Bible.
All right. Okay. It's certainly a pleasure to have you down here to share this story.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've listened to HPR and Catherine Cruz for years, and it's a pleasure to meet you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Chris Song, who is the regional spokesman for Jehovah's Witness. He sat down with us recently to talk about the latest translation of its Pidgin Bible. Look for links on our website later today. Does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about dam safety and its plantation-era history, given the close call that we saw on Oahu's North Shore. How's your neighborhood been affected by the rains and the wind? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.